Hello and welcome back to The Bunker. I'm Dr. Kate Devlin. In 2002, Elon Musk set up SpaceX with the lofty goal of reducing the cost of space travel and, eventually, pursuing the colonization of Mars. In the last 20 years, SpaceX have made some incredible breakthroughs. They were the first private company to send humans into orbit. They developed reusable spacecraft, and I'm sure we all remember when they sent a Tesla into space. Because of these achievements, SpaceX is now a household name, and Elon Musk is one of the richest men on the planet. But despite what he may want you to believe, Musk doesn't have a monopoly in space. Hundreds of startups across the world are trying to make science fiction ideas a reality. From opening up mining colonies on the moon to intergalactic cruise ships, the future is bright for space entrepreneurs. And governments are getting in on the action too, with increasing competition to get the tech upper hand by going to outer space. But what does that mean for the rest of us? And how will developments in space change the way we live here on Earth? To give me the rundown of the most exciting space startups, I'm joined by physicist and founder of Terraform Industries, Dr. Casey Handmer. Casey, welcome to The Bunker.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Let me start by asking you, how is SpaceX doing and how is it living up to making Musk's goals a reality?
SpaceX seems to be doing really well right now. It's been at it for 21 years, but they're launching rockets more than once a week, which is more than anyone would have dreamed was possible when they started out.
And looking at the big players in the field right now, who then are the rising stars in the market outside of SpaceX?
That's a great question. Actually, Ashley Vance, who's a well-known writer in this area, just published a fabulous book called When the Heavens Went on Sale to talk about a number of the other companies attempting to build rockets and launch them, including Firefly and Astra, as well as SpaceX and Rocket Lab, and of course, there's Virgin Orbit and Blue Origin and a bunch of other companies. Unfortunately, the truth of the matter is that until you've reached orbit, it's very hard to know if you're doing the right thing. And actually, I think both Astra and Virgin Orbit did successfully reach orbit, but their success rate was not high and they weren't able to improve it. And so as of today, Virgin Orbit has officially gone out of business. Firefly and Astra are burning cash at a rate that does not seem compatible with long-term survival. So it's a bit of a challenge there. It's super tough, right? Successfully building a private company that can launch rockets to space, it requires solving a huge variety of problems and not all of them technical. So it's a really tough problem. But you know, it's not to say that any of the people involved in these companies couldn't successfully go out and raise a couple of hundred million more dollars and try again with having learned from the mistakes they made the first time around and succeed. So SpaceX is really only one or two successful competitor startups away from losing market share, but they do currently have an incredible lead on essentially all facets of the business.
So in the past, the space race seemed to really focus on national identity. Why is it that the modern space race is more defined by branding and personalities rather than nationalism?
I think that the original space race grew out of development of ICBMs, which obviously a national technology, and required the investment of trillions of dollars, which is beyond the spending power of all but the richest governments on Earth. But nowadays, we've seen a slight reduction in the amount of money that needs to be spent with a commensurate increase in the amount of demand. And that enables servicing by sufficiently aggressive and clever private companies. But it's important to remember that even in the early days, NASA itself was not necessarily building rockets. It was contracting with private companies. So it's everything old is new again.
So coming back down to Earth for a moment, there's a lot of emphasis on making other planets habitable. But is this something that we could actually use here when we're facing a climate crisis?
Well, of course, and there's been a lot of speculation one way or the other. But that's significantly more speculative than the nuts and bolts of kind of SpaceX's current day-to-day operations, even though what they're doing also appears to be science fiction.
Can you talk me a little through that? I mean, what is it that makes it harder on Earth than it does in space?
Well, I mean, the day-to-day of building and launching rockets, putting satellites in space, and then developing hardware for lunar exploration, this is all stuff that's been done 50 years ago. Just the sheer requirement of material and investment required to either terraform Mars or terraform some other planet, or change Earth's climate. It's really many orders of magnitude beyond that in terms of the sheer amount of effort required. Just to kind of put that in perspective, yes, humans have managed to warm the Earth by a couple of degrees, maybe one or so degrees, but that's been like concerted effort by nearly every human alive for the last 200 years in our entire industrial economy, tearing carbon out of the ground and burning it. And so it's it's really, I can't exaggerate here. It takes a lot of effort to to really turn the ship there.
SpaceX moved their operations to Texas. Could we see a migration away from Silicon Valley when it comes to space? And if so, would Texas be the logical home of space tech?
I think Texas is, you know, quite business friendly in many ways, which is certainly helpful when it comes to rockets because they're very noisy. But it's a common misconception, actually, that that SpaceX is based in Silicon Valley. SpaceX was actually always based in Los Angeles and in Southern California, and they've almost always had operations in Texas because they were doing engine tests there since the very early days. And so, you know, SpaceX currently has operations in the western part of the United States and Southern California, and also in several different locations in Texas, and also in Florida, where they do a lot of launches, and they've also got offices, you know, other parts of the world. So it's a very, very large company.
So it sounds like there's an awful lot going on in aerospace technology at the moment. So what are the recent advancements that have got you excited about the future of the industry?
Well, just on this front, I would say that all of us have been holding our breath for years now, waiting for Starship to launch. It's been clear to people watching closely that SpaceX could have lit that candle anytime they wanted, up to a constant in regulatory approval, but that the design teams and so on were still rapidly iterating and improving the design. But still they launched that rocket and almost everything that could go wrong did go wrong, and the thing still flew for 4 minutes, and it was absolutely glorious, and it really. It kind of speaks to the dedication and the ambition of the team down there in South Texas, which I've had the privilege of visiting, and just how hard they're trying to make that thing work, because it's really, in many ways, a revolutionary transportation product. It really changes the way that we can access space for the better.
I can really hear the excitement in your voice there when you talk about that. Can you tell us a little about what it's like to visit there at SpaceX in Texas?
Okay, so I don't know exactly where your audience is, but I suspect some of them in the UK. Texas is a little bit different to the UK, and in particular, this part of Texas is quite remote. It's kind of desolate. It's a marine estuary, but this kind of series of coastal sand dunes, and then there's these areas where SpaceX has basically taken over a couple of islands that are just a few feet above sea level, and proceeded to as you all seen, like, start with a tent and then start welding together a water tower and then slap a rocket on it and then launch it and then iterate and nowadays. It's fairly astounding what's going on there. So there's about 300,000 square feet, which is about 30,000 square meters, under cover of manufacturing space, which is one of the larger factories in the world. Obviously, it has to be large because the rocket is huge. And then there are several high bays, which are basically skyscrapers with holes in the sides, where they can assemble the rings, the components of the rocket, and move them around by crane. And then put them on trucks and move them down to the launch site. And then when I was there, the booster was on the launch pad waiting for the Starship to be integrated on top and then launched. And it's at a scale that boggles the mind. I think rockets are a technology that exists across many sizes. Probably the SpaceX's main competitor in terms of technology and success is a company called Rocket Lab, which is based in New Zealand originally. And their rocket, which I've also had the privilege of seeing shortly before its first launch, is comparatively tiny. You can fit it on the back of a truck, a modest sized truck. You could fit it in an airplane. If your house had a long enough corridor, you could kind of fit it in there. So it's very exciting. But the Starship rocket is absolutely enormous. It's a behemoth, and everything there is on a grand scale. I mean, they say that everything's bigger in Texas, there you are. It's kind of in the middle of nowhere in this kind of like desolate, salty, marshy desert. And then suddenly there's this factory that is producing rockets that have the best chance we've ever seen in the history of humanity of taking large numbers of humans into space and then having them live there. It's quite remarkable.
So space tourism has always been one of those sci-fi tropes, but how do you imagine that sector might grow in the future?
Well, I think, as I said before, as the price comes down, we tend to see additional sources of demand, and this is well known. And actually, some of the first space tourists occurred, I think, in the 90s, but we've seen significantly more of that recently. We're now into the almost the tens of space tourists, particularly with suborbital flight. And I can only hope that further developments of Starship and so on continue to lower the cost of human spaceflight to the point where, instead of it costing a couple of $1 million a day to put someone in space, maybe it only costs $1,000 a day, which is, comparable to an extremely expensive vacation, or maybe even less. And it just, increases the number of organizations that can afford to operate with, meaningful quantities of humans in space from like one or two to potentially hundreds or even thousands. And that means that the opportunity will exist for, someone who whose career might previously have taken them on occasion to the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, or you know, some advanced synchrotron light source, you know, some other rather expensive piece of scientific equipment. You know, maybe now it'll be cheaper to operate that sort of thing in space or to do similar types of experiments in space. So whereas, you know, maybe in the past it would be the highlight of a career to go and work on a synchrotron or to work in Antarctica or something, maybe, you know, space will be in that same kind of tier, which would be super cool. Like that'd be, you know, tens of thousands of people could be living and working in space or you know, flying up there and bouncing around in a space station.
And would you like to go?
Yeah, I think it'd be pretty neat.
So if you had to place a bet on a specific company being the next SpaceX, and you can't say your own, which would it be?
Oh, well, Terraform Industries, my company, is not a launch company. We're a synthetic fuel company. So like, you know, we may end up someday doing something in space. I mean, I would not be opposed to that, but we're not a launch company. In terms of companies that may come up and give SpaceX a run for their money, this is a bit difficult. It's a little bit like asking like what electric car company is going to compete with Tesla, because not only is you know, Tesla many, many years ahead of the competition, they're also increasing their lead. And that's kind of the situation we see with SpaceX as well. But that said, you know, the talent at SpaceX is fungible. People get hired out of SpaceX every day. You know, Blue Origin has plenty of money. It'd be nice to see them reach orbit. Rocket Lab has reached orbit now dozens of times with their rather small rocket. It'll be interesting to see if they can scale up the size of their rocket there and stay in business. And then, of course, foreign governments, you know, essentially if they got out of their own way, might be able to meaningfully compete. But particularly, unfortunately, we see with like the Europeans, the Chinese, and the Russians, and you know, to a lesser extent, maybe the Japanese and Indians, who also do national space programs with their own indigenous launch vehicles. It seems that the primary obstacle to them competing effectively with SpaceX is admitting that there's a problem. And so it would be really nice to see that kind of barrier be lifted.
So I'd like to ask you about that. So is there any hope for us over here in Europe or the UK? Do you think we can make it in the space race?
That's two separate questions. Also, I think the UK can be, I think the UK in particular can be proud of its you know, consistent contributions to technology. Just last night, because I'm a geek, I was writing down a family tree of all the world's jet engines. And of course, some of the first successful jet engines were built and tested in the UK, not to mention, you know, the earlier parts of the Industrial Revolution. You know, UK has a slight geographic disadvantage, at least under current rocket paradigms, because generally speaking, rockets are launched to the east, and UK doesn't have like lots and lots of ocean immediately to its east. I mean, I guess you could launch from Gibraltar or something, but you know, maybe when rockets are reliable enough that they're considered like planes, then it's not such a big deal to fly over other people's territory, because you're not like dropping rocket stages on other people's cities. So that's the thing. But I think that, you know, the UK would do well to kind of focus on its existing strengths, particularly in scientific exploration, you know, spacecraft, satellite development, and so on, and just kind of stop looking for some universal panacea and just realize that, like, actually, you know, developing the talent and the technique and the skills in these areas is a decades-long process, and you can't just kind of give up or hope to import it. UK is actually the only country on Earth to have had independent space access twice and lost it twice, which I think is not something to be proud of. And then the European Union in general, well, I'm very far from an expert, but I would say that, you know, it's finally come out now. I mean, what has been obvious to industry outsiders like myself, frankly, for more than a decade, is that, you know, the Ariane series of rockets is not positioned to compete with what Falcon 9 was 10 years ago, let alone what Falcon 9 is today, let alone what Starship will be in the immediate future. And the sooner they realize that, the sooner they'll, you know, potentially be able to change course and actually put money into something that has a hope of succeeding. And I think it's super important for Europe and the UK as well to have independent access to space, be able to launch and build its own GPS satellites, all that kind of stuff. It's kind of a critical geopolitical, you know, strategic security imperative. And unfortunately, the organization, I think the people involved are probably well-intentioned, but the organization as a whole is acting like they don't intend to succeed, which is, it's a real problem. It's a real problem.
So is there something to be said for some form of better international collaboration on this? And I'm thinking in terms of recently, we've seen all these headlines about artificial intelligence, and there's trying to get task force going so that we have some kind of global approach. Is that something that would work well for space as well?
I don't know. I'm an Australian originally who migrated to the United States. So I think that my views on the matter might be somewhat out of distribution, which is to say that I don't think that you know, regulation that mandates kind of global coordination is the answer. And I think that the politicians who think that, you know, signing some bilateral agreement with the United States or with SpaceX or with, I don't know, someone else will magically solve the problems caused by decades of underinvestment in, you know, critical core capabilities and then, you know, failing to hold the organizations that are responsible for assuring this access accountable are unlikely to solve the problem, right? And unfortunately, like one thing that this always seems to be the case at NASA is that inviting in foreign participants into your program makes the program harder to cancel, but it also almost certainly makes it much more expensive to execute. Just because of coordination problems. And one of the reasons that small companies like mine, small startups like SpaceX, were able to take on the industrial titans and crush them was that they didn't have to pay those coordination overheads, right? They were able to get all the people whose decisions mattered in the same small room and hammer it out in kind of in a Skunk Works-like fashion. And it's really the only thing that these tiny startups have going for them. It's the only way they can really compete. And unfortunately, you know, UK and EU now is kind of in an underdog position where people, the key decision makers, they need to be empowered. They need to be told, this is your mission. You have to achieve it. Yeah, they have to be given resources. And then the people, you know, the overseers have to get out of the way, right? They have to be given a long leash and allowed to actually solve the problem as opposed to having constant interference. So as I said, my views on the matter may be a minority, and often political realities kind of dictate the structure of these programs. But unfortunately, like, you know, politics is in some ways negotiable, but physics is not. And the harder your problem, the harder your program, the more physics is going to kick your ass when you screw it up.
Politics is negotiable, physics is not. I think that's a good motto. Is there anything that you'd like to add that I haven't asked about?
Well, I just think that, you know, I wouldn't say I'm the first generation. I might be the fourth or fifth generation of geek who grew up dreaming about space. And unfortunately, you know, a lot of my older compatriots or whatever spent their entire careers doing things that are meaningful and worthwhile, but nevertheless, you know, never really approached the same to the same degree of nearness, the current level of takeoff, if that makes any sense. It really feels like there's some momentum building now, and I think we should do our best to maintain that. I think that it's absolutely necessary that the UK, you know, continue to aggressively invest in the space, so that its, you know, younger, up and coming, early career engineers have something to do, right? Because like ultimately, that's a source of wealth in an organization, or a source of wealth in a civilization, is innovators who are inventing new things to do. And unfortunately, if they don't have worthy problems to work on, they'll go and do something boring. Not that, you know, finance and law are necessarily boring, but they're not productive in the same way. I think that, you know, in some ways, I worry that the UK has lost sight of the fact that wealth is generated by people inventing new things.
So is education going to be key to this?
I think education is important, but actually, I mean, the UK is not known for having poor education. In many ways, I think the UK probably has a pretty good educational system. It's able to identify the people who are very interested and have a lot of potential in these areas. It's able to get them the skills and the access to knowledge that they need. And obviously, we have the internet, we have YouTube, we have various publicly available servers full of NASA technical documents that tell you essentially how to do all this stuff. But you know what there doesn't exist is, like, you know, the pipeline. How does someone who's a freshly minted undergraduate degree in aerospace engineering in the United Kingdom or in the EU get to go and cut their teeth working alongside the top people in a particular field trying to solve the hardest problems? And unfortunately, the answer is, you know, at best, maybe they migrate to the United States. And that's really hard to do, especially for rocket technology. It's really, really hard to do because, you know, rockets are considered weapons technology. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, part of the reason that United States pays $20-something billion a year to keep NASA in business is that having, you know, strategic reserve of 20,000 or so super geeks who know how to make rockets is critical. For national security. You can't just invent that the moment you need it. And I think that unfortunately, a lot of countries have lost sight of that fact. You absolutely have to put in the money and invest over long periods of time to make sure you have those capabilities, and you have to maintain those capabilities. And if you don't, they'll just disappear. So I think right now, like if the UK found itself, you know, between, you know, absolute demise as a country and its ability to build and launch a new rocket into space, like it did in the 1960s with the Black Arrow, it may not be able to do it. And that's a real worry. Maybe just as an experiment, someone should test this theory and see if a new rocket company in the UK can actually successfully build and launch a rocket. Because I think there'd be a lot of people out there who would doubt that that's possible.
There you go. That's one heck of a challenge. Casey, thank you so much for joining me in The Bunker.
That's my pleasure. Thank you.
Listeners, if you enjoyed this episode, please support The Bunker on Patreon. For as little as £3 a month, you can get extras. And in addition to that warm, glowing feeling you get from knowing you're supporting independent media. I'm Dr. Kate Devlin. Thanks for listening.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now? The politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof, or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fearn, guest Nikki McCann-Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Bunker was written and presented by Dr. Kate Devlin. The producer was Liam Tate, with audio production by me, Simon Williams. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis. The group editor is Andrew Harrison. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by James Parrott, The Bunker is a Podmasters production.